There have been at least 10 recent incidents on Valley freeways with cars hit by bullets or other projectiles. Law enforcement's asking for help, but not panic.
We just want the public to avoid distractions, to pay attention to your surroundings, use those mirrors. We don't want you to be in fear. We just want you to be attentive.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, new research on the move of childhood hunger to the suburbs, efforts to bridge the gap between police and the communities they serve.
Is the rising cost of prescription drugs making it harder to get them?
And Arizona and California try to be neighborly about water.
I think we need to focus more on how we can work together than how we need to protect ourselves from each other.
Plus, building a guitar and the fiscal impact of legal recreational pot.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll stay cloudy for the rest of this afternoon. And we may reach a high temperature of 95. Then for tonight, partly cloudy with a 20% chance for showers and a low around 80 degrees. Currently with relative humidity at 39%, we're cloudy and 92 degrees. One quick check on the Valley freeways. I-10 eastbound, a collision at 7th Avenue is blocking two right lanes.
The Arizona Department of Public Safety confirms an 11th incident in the past 2 weeks being investigated along I-10 in Phoenix. KJZZ's Phil Latzman has the latest.
Valley drivers and residents remain on high alert after a series of highway incidents being classified as domestic terrorism. The latest involves a gunshot hitting the side of a semi-truck along I-10 this morning near 83rd Avenue. DPS spokesman Raul Garcia says they've received hundreds of tips and encourages them to keep coming.
Somebody knows something about this. Somebody knows this suspect or suspects, and we're asking that individual or those individuals not to sit around and wait for this to turn into a fatality.
No one has been seriously hurt. As the search continues, there are now reports of vigilantes. Garcia says no one should take matters into their own hands.
It adds to confusion when we're tying up resources to respond to reports of armed individuals. Law enforcement has to check each one of those incidents out.
Of the 11 confirmed incidents being linked since August 29th, 8 are of gunshots hitting vehicles. The other 3 are believed to be projectiles, not considered shots from a firearm. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Grand Canyon officials announced today Zantara will continue to provide lodging, food, bus, and mule rides on the South Rim for at least another 15 years. The contract is worth $66 million a year in gross revenue. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Zantara has maintained historic hotels and restaurants at the Grand Canyon for over a century. Last year, the park owed the longstanding concessioner $157 million in building repairs. At the same time, the contract was up for bid. That repair bill scared away many prospective bidders. So the Grand Canyon started paying down the debt by borrowing from other parks and cutting some of its educational programs. Up until recently, the concessioner paid only 3.8% in franchise fees to the park. Under the new contract, Zantara will pay at least 8%. Grand Canyon officials hope the increased fee will help them pay back their loans from other parks, restore cut programs, and fix a leaking water pipeline. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Arizona gas prices dropped almost 5.5 cents from last week. A gallon of regular unleaded now costs on average $2.49. AAA Arizona says prices have dropped for 55 straight days for a total of 36 cents a gallon overall. The group expects prices to continue going down as fewer people hit the roads this fall. That's as long as the price of crude stays fairly low and there are no problems with refineries. Childhood hunger is migrating to the suburbs. A report released today shows nationally the number of students eligible for free or reduced lunch grew faster in suburbs than cities, rural areas, and small towns between 2006-07 and 2012-13. That trend is also showing up in Arizona. Chris Destish works with the Arizona Fair Share Education Fund. The national group put out the report.
In just Maricopa County alone, there's basically 250,000 children, quarter of a million, that are food insecure in the basically Phoenix metro area. And the thing that we want to drive home here is that it's not just an urban issue anymore. It's in really every community. the national statistics are 48% of food insecure children actually live in the suburbs now, not in urban areas or, you know, out in the country as one usually imagines.
Why has this changed?
A big part was the Great Recession, actually, in 2008. After that, kind of the landscape of hunger and poverty changed. People who normally would be considered suburban became impoverished. You know, where they lived didn't change, but their economic status did.
It looks as though Phoenix had one of the larger increases over time of the number of suburban kids who had food insecurities. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. The number for Arizona in particular, which the greater part of the statistics from Arizona come from Phoenix, the number is 28% in terms of childhood hunger. So that's almost one in three kids.
Is that just a function of the fact that the housing crisis hit here harder than some other places?
That is a huge part of it. You know, subprime mortgages, people getting stuck with mortgages they couldn't pay. And so the end result is that there are thousands of parents, millions in America, that have to choose between paying, you know, their rent and their utilities, paying off their mortgages, and feeding their children.
So what do we do about this?
The first step is awareness about the issue. What FairShare in particular is trying to do is change the way people think about hunger and food insecurity. I know, you know, as a kid growing up, I thought of a food insecurity as something far off, something that didn't affect me in particular. But what we're trying to show people is that it's something that is in every community. It's pervasive. It's a problem that we can't just sweep under the rug anymore. So we're trying to get the word out about food insecurity in a couple different states in particular in order to influence legislators later on. We have to build the groundswell of support before we can influence Congress, basically.
So does that mean that this problem will likely persist for a little while until you're able to do that and then get some kind of congressional action?
Yes, it does, unfortunately.
What has the movement of food insecurity from the cities to the suburbs meant both for nonprofits that try to help folks dealing with this, but also governments, both at the city and state level, but also the federal government?
It just means we need to reframe how we think about food insecurity. The suburbs are a very large part of America, and they are now the main source of food insecurity. So that amounts to nearly 6.5 million suburban children who are eligible for free or reduced price lunch, which is actually more than the number of children from rural areas and small to mid-sized towns combined.
Chris Destish with Arizona Fair Share Education Fund. Chris, thank you.
Hey, thank you so much.
The Gold King mine spill in Silverton, Colorado, led to the release of 3 million gallons of toxic waste that impacted the Navajo Nation, along with Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah. On Wednesday, Congress stepped in with a hearing held by the House Science Committee to find out what happened. Committee Chair Lamar Smith of Texas criticized the EPA in his opening statement.
Had the EPA exercised the same care in making their decisions as an ordinary, prudent person, this whole incident could have been avoided. Unfortunately, EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy has declined to appear before this committee and answer questions about the role her agency played in causing this preventable spill. Perhaps she doesn't have any good answers.
Matthew Stanislaus, Assistant Administrator for the EPA, represented the agency.
What we know at this moment is the internal review concluded that this was identified up front. The work plan incorporated these careful measures. The experts of EPA and the state of Colorado looked at the site conditions, looked at seeps, looked at flows, and concluded that there were a low-pressure situation.
The spill has troubled many, both through actual damage it caused and perception based on the nauseating color it turned the waters. But there have been technological advances in environmental cleanup that help limit the problems. Bruce Rittman is director of the Sweetie Center for Environmental Biotechnology at ASU. Bruce, many people were alarmed by the images they saw of the water after the mine spill, and I imagine you were too. But were you able to process it differently because you could look at it in more of a problem-solving kind of way?
Well, I was shocked at how it looked, and I knew what was in that water, so I, you know, I also knew what was behind the visual aspect of it and why this was so devastatingly bad at the time. But at the same time, I also understand that this was a short-term leak. It was going to stop, and that this really bad situation was going to pass.
There has been a concern in Arizona, not just in Arizona, but in other states, about old mining sites that are not used anymore, and there's a lot of waste going on there. If money were no object, are there certain things you would like to see done or certain advances that could, in fact, assist that if the commitment were made to clean up those sites?
There are technologies, some chemical technologies, some microbiological technologies that can be used to remove the contaminants from the water. Also, a part of the problem with the mine waste waters is that they're very, very acidic, and so there are means to also get rid of the acidity, raise the pH, and make them much less hazardous in that regard. So, yes, technologies are available or being developed for that. They do cost some money, and so when you have abandoned mine sites and there's no one taking financial responsibility for them, then the weak link is actually finding someone who will pony up to do the technologies.
It does seem like the issue of clean water is certainly less based on legislation that has happened over the past several decades to make sure we remain clean. But are there still some trouble spots you'd be concerned about or certain potential things where if we don't keep close watch, we don't regulate it well, that could develop into issues?
One big problem that we have in this country, and it's a worldwide problem, is the discharge of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, to the waters, not from wastewater treatment in industry or human activities, but mainly from agriculture, that is fertilizers. This is a very difficult problem because we actually apply the fertilizers to the land out in the open, and of course it rains and they run off or they drain off. And so this is a very difficult problem. But it's also a problem that's causing huge water quality problems and economic problems. One that's a very important one in Arizona is the legacy of all the uranium mining that was done in the northern part of Arizona and Utah and mostly on the Navajo lands. And now there's a tremendous amount of contamination of the groundwater as well as the soils with uranium. And this is another big, big problem that doesn't fit into the conventional area where we've already got good solutions. So we need some innovative technologies as well as policies that will help us be able to implement those technologies in an effective way.
Bruce Rittman, director of the Sweetie Center for Environmental Biotechnology at ASU.
Coming up, if Arizona goes to pot, will schools benefit?
Prohibition of marijuana has failed, and it makes sense for us to tax and regulate the sales of marijuana with the proceeds benefiting education.
But would it truly be the education cash cow proponents claim it can be? That's just ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. These clouds you're seeing right now will stick with us through the rest of the afternoon, and we expect to top out at around 95 degrees. Then for tonight, partly cloudy with a 20% chance for rain, lows around 80. Then for tomorrow at least, we're expecting sunny skies, drier conditions with a high of 103. Currently, relative humidity is at 39%. Cloudy skies, 92 degrees at KJZZ. Meanwhile, on the Valley freeways, an accident on the 202 westbound Santan Freeway at Dobson. That's blocking the HOV lane. And if you're on I-10 westbound, watch out for a disabled vehicle that's blocking the shoulder at Central Avenue.
KJZZ is supported by Bonhams Auctioneers and Appraisers. Bonhams Jewelry Specialists will visit Arizona September 15th and 16th to provide confidential auction estimates for your fine jewelry. Details at bonhams.com/Arizona.
This summer, the headline of an article in the Arizona Daily Star asked simply, is California trying to take our water? Environmental reporter Tony Davis, who wrote the story, says a big component of that question was the secrecy surrounding a bill being worked on by California Senator Dianne Feinstein.
Based on the interviews I had, particularly with the Central Arizona Project and other sources, that was a core part of it, is they just didn't know what was going on. And when you don't know what's going on, it's going to fuel some of the paranoia, okay? That's a natural human instinct.
Have you found since that after the details came out that people are less concerned about this possibility?
You know, I have not found out anything since then. I haven't followed up. I think that the fact that the bill didn't have anything to do with taking water from the Colorado River that was Arizona's allocation, I think those facts have caused the concern to go down in the sense that I haven't heard anything about it lately. But no source has told me that for the record. You know, it's just nobody's talking about this now. It just seems less likely.
Tony Davis covers the environment for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson. There is some precedent for Arizona and California to have some neighborly disputes about water. In 1934, Arizona's governor sent the National Guard to observe the construction of Parker Dam, which the state opposed. But are the two states on better water terms now? To find out, we turn to Ted Cook, interim general manager of Central Arizona Project. And Ted, are you concerned about California dipping into Arizona's water supply?
I guess concern is a word that covers a wide range. I'm concerned in that Arizona is last in the priority on the Colorado River among the Colorado River Basin states. But the law of the river is pretty well defined, and so the risk of California taking some of Arizona's water without us noticing it is pretty remote. On the other hand, California did use a lot of Arizona's water for a long time with our knowledge. I think the rhetoric has become a little bit overheated in this regard. I think we need to focus more on how we can work together than how we need to protect ourselves from each other.
Do states tend to work together on these kinds of issues? I mean, I know there's sort of a natural competition because there's a pecking order of who gets water and in what order, but are the states generally collegial in this area?
I think collegial is a good word. It is sometimes friendlier than other times, and that depends on what the specific discussion is and what the areas of commonality are. There are lots of little technical details about the way that water is accounted for, and those sometimes can result in differences of opinion or arguments and things like that. But in general, I think it is a collegial atmosphere.
When states face the kinds of problems that California is facing right now, and maybe it's just more perhaps in the news right now, does that tend to strain things? I mean, does that make folks in California maybe a little more nervous and maybe a little more apt to not necessarily try to steal water, but to try to adjust so that they're able to get what they need, perhaps at the expense of other states?
Yeah, I think maybe without maybe leaving out the last part about at the expense of other states. But I think the previous part of that statement was correct, that California has got a dire situation. They have they're suffering from the drought, both that affects the southern part of their state with the Colorado River supply and the northern part of their state at the same time. And so, like anyone would, they're trying to find a way to alleviate that problem by being creative, by using the accounting rules to their advantage, if at all possible. I don't believe that most parties would deliberately try to defraud, let's say, another state.
Is that something that you or your organization keeps an eye on, though, just to make sure?
Well, we do, but we really rely on the Secretary of the Interior, the Department of the Interior, the Bureau of Reclamation, who's responsible for Colorado River accounting to keep tracks of those kinds of things.
As this drought persists throughout the West, do you envision any changes in, as you say, the law of the Colorado River?
I don't see any of the big types of changes that some folks might envision to the law of the river, such as going back to the 1922 compact and redoing the allocations among the states or things like that. The law of the river is something that's very complex. It's accreted over a long period of time. Kind of wiping the slate clean and starting over is not really feasible to do. However, there are side agreements and other arrangements that can happen among the basin states. those type of things address new problems or new issues that weren't contemplated by the law of the river as it stands, but they can build upon it and they can deal with today's issues.
Ted Cook, the interim general manager for the Central Arizona Project. Ted, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our neighbor to the west is downplaying any talk of tension or conflict between the states over water from the Colorado. Tanya Trujillo is executive director of the Colorado River Board of California.
The people that I've been interacting with in Arizona have not been panicking or alarmists. Even the most current press release I've seen from the State of Arizona and Central Arizona Project indicate that they're prepared for addressing shortages, if that's what we're looking at on the Colorado River. We've been working very cooperatively amongst the seven basin states for approximately 15 years on innovative agreements to help us all manage water in the system. In the lower basin in particular, we've had very successful history of trying to put agreements together that help us save water in Lake Mead and allocate water in ways that make sense for all of the states.
As you talked about the cooperation, is that something that needs to go forward, and do you expect it to go forward, where the states are still communicating well, working together well?
That's my expectation, that there will be continued cooperation, and I think it's served all of the states well to follow that approach. I think the more flexibility we can have, the more options we have for addressing whatever conditions we see down the road.
When we think about agreements like this, is this something that do you think needs to come from all levels of government, in the sense that congressional delegations need to get together, that also members of the state, maybe governors, need to speak on this as well? Is this something that, because the issue of water is so important, that the communication needs to come from all those different levels?
Yeah, I don't see this being an issue that Congress needs to address. The tradition has been in the Colorado River Basin that the basin states can work amongst themselves and with the Bureau of Reclamation on management strategies that make sense for the river.
Does California, with the creativity involved and with the compacts involved, have enough water to go forward from the Colorado? When people in Arizona think about how the water is going to be shared going forward, can there be that trust factor, I guess I'm wondering?
Absolutely. I think there's significant trust in place. And the Bureau of Reclamation has a very robust accounting system that keeps us all in line. The Bureau evaluates literally every drop of water that is used in the lower basin, and we're all involved in reviewing that accounting process and eventually sign off on it on an annual basis. I think the uses in California and the steps taken in California have been very successful in ensuring that we are able to meet our water needs within our allocation and do not anticipate any change in that circumstance.
Tanya Trujillo, Executive Director of the Colorado River Board of California.
Police chiefs from all over the country are converging on Phoenix today, but it's not a raid. The show's Jimmy Jenkins joins us. And Jimmy, what is happening?
Well, the University of Phoenix is hosting a bridge summit where chiefs of police from Seattle, Oakland, Denver, Cleveland, Atlanta, Miami, and Phoenix will discuss best practices for connecting their departments with the communities they serve.
How did we get to this current state of affairs, that the relationship is broken down between police and their communities?
I asked that very question of one of the event organizers, Dr. Garland Williams. He's a retired Army colonel who now serves as the dean of the College of Security and Criminal Justice at the University of Phoenix.
A lot of what we're finding, I think, is just communication. You know, if the police have set up barriers maybe to communicate with their different parts of their community, and the community needs to be told what's going on. You know, one of the things that I think our community are looking for is access to policies. You know, what has the police been trained to do, and what are they going to do in certain instances?
How do you think it came to this point where police departments are somewhat detached from the communities that they serve?
There's all kinds of reasons, and you know, some of them that we have seen in the past where maybe a police department quickly grew when the population grew, say, 20 years ago, but it didn't grow with the demographics as the demographics changed in the community. And I'm not suggesting that the police department has to exactly mirror what those demographics are, but that police department does need to be out within the community. So when something goes wrong, the community will automatically go to the police department to help solve it. And when something goes right, they can help perpetuate that. You know, we need to make sure that our community is not afraid to deal with the police, and that we also need to make sure that the only time they deal with the police is not in a negative position.
Would a more educated police force help with this communication issue? Do you think it should be a requirement for a police officer to have a criminal justice degree?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I do. That's a various policy question across the different police departments. Sometimes you see police departments that require an associate's degree, some that require a bachelor's degree. You know, and the reason I say it's a good idea is because what we have wrapped up into all our courses is critical thinking. You know, when we talk to our chiefs of police, they're looking for their police officers to be able to make a rapid assessment of whatever situation they're in, try to get as many facts as they can, and then make a decision of what they need to do. That doesn't come usually by osmosis. You usually have to go through some kind of training to get to that point where you can do that well and do that quickly. I think the bachelor's degree is able to provide that. I also believe that the bachelor's degree allows a police officer to mature. You can look at life a little bit more critically, maybe take a tactical patience pause when something happens rather than rush into the, you know, the heat of the battle, if you will. Very similar to what we train our military. You know, make sure you assess the situation before you do something rash.
Are there a lot of members of the military that go through your college to then become police officers?
Yeah, actually 40% of our students are prior service military. You know, criminal justice and security is sort of a natural transition from the security pieces that they did in the military. You know, in the Army, regardless of what your specialty is, your primary job is to fight as infantry. You know, that's what your primary job is.
Is there a bit of a challenge then to change that mindset from being a military officer to a community servant and protector?
You know, it's interesting because the military operates under something called rules of engagement. And if you look over the last several decades, we've gone and done everything from high kinetic warfare when we did a direct force-on-force with Iraq, for example, to low-intensity conflict where we worked insurgent, to peacekeeping. And our military service members have adjusted to each of those missions, in my view, very, very admirably. It's the same way as being a police officer. Sometimes you may have to use force. You may have to go in there with force, depending on the situation. Most times you don't. I mean, if you talk to the average police officer, most have not fired their gun in anger during a 20-year career, but some have. Same as a military service member. You know, that they have been able to work under those rules of engagement to adapt their skills to whatever's at hand. And so I think it is a really good transition to the criminal justice field and the police officer field to be able to do the same thing.
Well, Garland Williams, thank you very much for your time.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
That's the show's Jimmy Jenkins.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Jenny Dickman. I'm a student here at Roberto Venn School of Lutheran. I've always been interested in music. I kind of wanted to perform, but never have been the stage presence type person, so I always wanted to do something more behind the scenes.
I'm ready to groove.
I've gone back and looked at my guitars at home and kind of seen what was used, tried to pick out the types of wood, and like, oh yeah, maybe they use that wood because it's got a little brighter tone.
I'm not going to completely tighten one down at a time.
If I could bring people closer or make them happier with music by playing a guitar that I've built, that would be great.
That's Jenny Dickman building a guitar at Roberto Venn School of Lutheran. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just think we need some retuning, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pavlovich. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. The day after tomorrow will be 3 days before Tuesday. What day is today? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. Coming up, New Mexico officials want to see the state's beloved chili pepper in recipes across the country. But with a labor shortage in the fields, that effort might not get very far.
We need more product, we can grow more product, but we can't find the people to harvest it.
The future of a New Mexican staple. That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon with Mark. I'm Steve. In Valley traffic, there's an accident on the 202 westbound, the Santan Freeway. It's at Dobson Road, and it's blocking the HOV lane. Also, if you're on the 51 southbound, look out for a short stretch of heavy slowing. Starts around Glendale and extends down to Coulter. Valley weather for the rest of the day is going to remain cloudy, and a high temperature might get up to 95 degrees. Then for tonight, the clouds will linger, and we have a 20% chance for rain. Expect lows to be around 80. The sun should come out tomorrow, and the temperature should go up to about 103. Currently, relative humidity is at 39%. It's cloudy, 92 degrees at KJZZ at 234.
KJZZ is supported by Zetejas Southwestern Grill, celebrating Hatch chili season with new menu items, including chili-crusted pork tenderloin with jalapeno grits, mint chimichurri, and green chili sauce. More at Zetejas.com.
The Tohono O'odham Nation says it'll open a new casino on the edge of Glendale in December, no matter what a federal judge rules. The tribe wants to run what's called a Class 3 casino with 1,000 slot machines and various table games. But State Gaming Director Daniel Bergen is refusing to issue the necessary permits, arguing the tribe committed fraud in not telling voters in 2002 that Proposition 202 had a provision that allowed the tribe to create a reservation in Maricopa County. Tohono O'odham Chairman Edward Manuel says the tribe, though, did nothing wrong.
At that time, we were contemplating. We have never made up our minds prior to 202 that we are going to put a casino there.
At a hearing today, an attorney for the tribe told Judge David Campbell he should overrule Bergen, but the tribe's chief gaming officer says the casino will open in December, and if Campbell does not issue an injunction, the tribe actually could operate without state permission by using a different type of slot machine. The judge is expected to rule within weeks.
Wildlife advocates are criticizing Utah officials for not suspending a coyote bounty program after they were told about a wolf sighting 1 month before a rare gray wolf was killed by a hunter who mistook it for a coyote. State officials defended their actions today, saying it was inconclusive if the sighting was a wolf.
In a look at global news, thousands of migrants continue to make their way towards Europe, and according to the United Nations, most of these refugees come from war-torn Syria. Under increasing pressure from the European Union, President Obama announced today the U.S. will accept at least 10,000 Syrian refugees the next fiscal year, which begins October 1st. Half the pre-war population of the country has now either fled or is displaced within it.
The exodus is being driven by a war that has now killed more than 200,000 people. BBC's Jeremy Bowen reports from Latakia, a stronghold of President Assad's regime.
I'm on one of the beaches in Latakia. Loads of families enjoying themselves as the sun dips down into the Mediterranean. Little kids playing at the water's edge, not dying at it. There's sunscreen, selfie sticks, even a spot of lager at the beach kiosk. You could almost be in Spain. This is the secular dream of Syria that President Assad still talks about. Most of the women here are wearing swimsuits or bikinis. There's a young man and woman walking down the beach. Let's have a word with them. How do you feel as a Syrian seeing the contrast of all of this? You can come down and hang out on the beach, yet there are loads of Syrians who are in a terrible, terrible state.
We want to live. And we want to survive. And we are living the crisis since 5 years.
We are just bored.
Everything's, you know, just finished. Going down.
84.9% of my friends are left the country because of the war and the crisis. Most of the people that I know, they don't have a military service. They went out. They went out of the country. I would like to fight with the army. But I think if I got a master or something, I can help the country, not with the gun or the weapon. I can fight with my country with the pen. War is bad. You see how war is bad.
This is a busy hospital. I'm walking down the corridor. There's a lot of men in uniform. Man's just come in. He's wearing field kit as well. He's got webbing and pouches. And some long-term patients here. They also treat the families of soldiers, but it's very busy, and there are a lot of young, wounded men, men with plaster, men with bandages, and their families, of course, grouping around them. In one of the rooms was Ahmed Zakharov. He's 22 years old and is recovering from a sniper bullet in the jaw. What is it like fighting at the front line? Tell me.
I'm not frightened. They are cowards to attack us. We will sacrifice our lives for the country and the president.
Some people say, I've read this in the newspapers in Britain and in Europe and in America, that young Syrian men like yourself, after 4 years, don't want to fight as much as before. Is that true for the president and for the army?
We will keep fighting until our last drop of blood for our country, for our president, for our honor. We will continue laying down our lives until we kill the last enemy. Even with these injuries, we will not stop fighting.
Outside, the body of a young soldier, Jamdab Numan, was being taken from the mortuary to his funeral in his home village. A little boy next to me crying, a little young girl's just fainted. It's a hot and a very emotional day for this village. A lot of men in uniform. They're Alawites, like the president, the religious minority that has become dominant in this country since the Assad family took over. This is the hard core of President Assad's support. The men of the village of Junduria gave a last loud salute to their dead colleagues. Some who left Syria early in the war hoped they'd return home fairly quickly. Now that the war's in its fifth year, they've realized that's not going to happen easily. They need to find another future. The refugee crisis is created and driven by war. Until the war ends, it will go on.
That was the BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen.
Even as more Americans have health insurance, the cost of prescription drugs is also on the rise. One medication that's received a lot of attention is Harvoni, used to treat hepatitis C. It costs $1,350 per pill. So what's the potential impact on healthcare and what doctors prescribe? Dr. Nicholas Vasquez is an emergency physician in the Valley and a board member at St. Luke's Health Initiatives. What do you as a medical professional consider when deciding what prescriptions a patient may need, other than the fact that they're suffering from a particular condition?
Well, mostly when medical professionals are deciding what they're going to use for treatment of a condition, it's mainly the condition. You're going to be given many options, whereas previously physicians didn't really have that many options. Over about a 25-year period, physicians have grown in the number of drugs that they use for certain conditions. I don't know for all of the physicians, but I know for many ER physicians, the price is probably the third or fourth thing that we'll consider. But it's becoming more and more relevant for us as people are paying more and more of a share of their insurance. The costs of prescriptions have definitely become a condition that patients are aware of. Before, it was just the uninsured, and those were folks that we used to see all the time, folks who had really no money and no means. You would try to find a way to keep it as generic and as cheap as possible. Now it's more than just the uninsured. It's a lot of people are very price sensitive.
You're thinking first and foremost about making sure that limiting the emergency and then moving on and helping the patient get better, and yet at the same time, you're still processing in your mind, well, I don't want to put this person too far in the lurch based on the cost of the prescription. That's interesting that you even had that in your mind.
I can give you a 30,000-foot viewpoint. The drug market is really an interesting situation right now where a majority of the medications that, say, I will use or some of my brethren will use are likely going to be generic. Those generic medications, antibiotics, antihypertensives, those medications have been taken over by a large generic manufacturers whose business model is to make a large number of medications as generic as possible. And then you have a whole different group of companies and a whole different group of drugs that are almost outside of where I practice. And that's either the lifestyle medications or the best way to put it is the orphan diseases. Anybody, you know, recently who's heard about that Hep C drug, and there's no other treatment for Hep C. You have one option, either live with it or try and treat it. And in that, the drug manufacturer who makes a drug for an orphan disease or a solo treatment has a lot of leverage over the market about what price they can bring. So for us in the emergency department, we're not sort of faced with that difficulty, but we're very aware of it. And a lot of what's driving the prices up in healthcare is demand for certain lifestyle drugs and the pricing advantage that drug companies have on certain conditions until they go generic.
We certainly want researchers to develop new drugs, again, whether they're for serious ailments or whether they're for those lifestyle choices. Is there a feeling that at some point we potentially miss out on some of the benefits because of the high costs once the drugs reach the market?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And it is really all about what the market size is. And I'll point out Ebola. Ebola has been a very lethal disease in very poor parts of the country since the 60s or 70s. And the threat was always there, but it never became important until it was a broader threat. The drugs that are required to fight diseases that don't have a lot of return on investment is one of the biggest problems that we have in pharmacy. And many of the drug makers will say that ultimately we exact more money out of the market for these lifestyle drugs so we can try to do something research-wise on these, you know, orphan drugs or orphan conditions. I don't know if that's true or not. When we have to pay a lot of money for our health care, and a lot of it comes in the terms of pharmaceuticals, a lot of people choose to go without, and we as a country, as a public, we're poorer for that.
ER physician Dr. Nicholas Vasquez, he's also a board member at St. Luke's Health Initiatives.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Check of Valley traffic, 202 westbound the Santan Freeway. An accident at Dobson has the HOV lane blocked. Cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon. 20% chance of showers and a high of 95. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight. Still that chance of rain. Overnight lows near 80. Mostly sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 103. Right now in Phoenix, relative humidity 39%. Cloudy and 92 degrees at 248.
KJZZ is supported by Fenimore Craig, a full-service law firm collaborating on new business ventures and technology startups for 130 years. FenimoreCraig.com.
Signatures are being gathered throughout the state for a proposed ballot initiative that would legalize the recreational use of marijuana in Arizona. Proponents promise taxes from the measure could provide at least $40 million annually for education. But as KJZZ's Phil Latzman found out, it's not quite that simple.
Backers of the measure, known as the Initiative to Regulate and Tax Marijuana-like Alcohol, say they've already gathered more than a third of the required signatures and expect it to appear on next year's November ballot. Scottsdale businessman J.P. Holyoke is leading the effort.
I'm wearing a business suit that I typically wear on most days. I'm an unapologetic conservative Republican, and it wasn't that long ago that I was an anti-marijuana person.
But then something happened.
My first daughter was born, and she's a special needs child. She was having seizures every single day. She was having between 25 and 35 seizures per day, each of them lasting between 8 and 12 minutes.
Holyoke says his now 6-year-old daughter, Reese, was diagnosed with Aicardi syndrome, a rare genetic disorder that affects the brain and triggers those seizures. Nothing worked until he says he got desperate and tried cannabis oil.
We took that leap. We tried it. And it worked. It has eliminated her seizures. She has gone from being unable to stand on her own 2 feet to walking independently. She is now feeding herself. She smiles, laughs, and plays every day, things that she didn't do prior to marijuana.
Medical pot passed in Arizona in 2010 and has worked for his daughter. But why take the leap to legalize it for recreational use?
People bring this question to me on a pretty regular basis, and I tell them that it's not a question of yes marijuana or no marijuana. because marijuana exists. It's out there and it's easily and readily available. The real question is, are we going to tax and regulate marijuana for the benefit of public education and healthcare, or are we going to keep it illegal for the enrichment of criminal drug cartels?
Not so fast, says Yavapai County Attorney Sheila Polk, who has long opposed pot legalization of any kind and disputes that last claim.
You know, the question isn't which is more harmful. The question is, are we better off as a society by legalizing a third addictive substance?
Polk says science points to marijuana's negative effects on the brain, especially on the developing minds of children.
Legalizing a substance so that you can get money while ignoring the negative public health consequences of the substance itself, particularly on our kids and their education, really is a really silly, bad choice.
Holyoke and others advocating for the initiative do have skin in the game. He's gotten involved in the medical pot business now and stands to benefit if it's legalized recreationally. Polk says therein lies the real motivation.
What's written into this initiative is the opportunity for certain groups of folks to make a lot of money off of the commercial for-profit sell of marijuana.
The measure, though, does call for a 15% sin tax on marijuana that proponents say would help pour more than $40 million annually into the state's education budget. For comparison, we reached out to a neighboring state, which made the recreational sale of pot legal in 2014. Skylar McKinney is deputy director of Colorado's Office of Marijuana Coordination.
So all told, what we like to say is, the sky has not fallen.
But, says McKinley, profits aren't falling out of the sky either, and that it would be a mistake to legalize marijuana by marketing it as a windfall for education.
To date, the state of Colorado has brought in about $120 million from the sales of recreational and medical marijuana, and that's since January 2014. That sounds like a lot of money. It sounds like a meaningful amount of money. But then consider the fact that education outlays alone are about $5.6 billion. So we're talking about a drop in the bucket.
It would be a slightly larger drop in Arizona's smaller education bucket, where the budget totals only $3.8 billion. Colorado taxes pot at 10%, 5% below what's being proposed in Arizona. But in Denver, McKinley warns Arizona not to base its state budget on the sale of buds.
When we talk about a sin tax or a vice tax that we have on marijuana or tobacco or alcohol, to really rely on that to fund schools, to pay teachers, to pave roads, it creates this perverse incentive in government for people to want to use that vice, and that's something you want to avoid.
Holyoke says his $40 million estimate is a conservative one.
We're looking at about $75 million that will flow into state coffers, 80% of which will go directly to public education here in Arizona. That number comes out, you know, 80% of $75 million is about $60 million.
Back in northern Arizona, Polk disputes those numbers.
What I'm saying to voters in Arizona is, let's slow down and watch this grand social experiment play out in Colorado. Let Colorado experiment on their kids. Let's not experiment on Arizona's kids. And let Colorado gather the data.
And even in Colorado, Skylar McKinley agrees.
My advice, frankly, would be, hey, let's not jump the gun on this. Let's see how things are going in Colorado, how things are going in Washington State, how things are going in Oregon, how things are going in Alaska, all of which have different regulatory approaches, and take a step back and then make that determination.
Assuming the campaign to tax and regulate marijuana like alcohol gets its required signatures, the measure will appear on the Arizona ballot in time for November of 2016. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
New Mexicans are very proud of their chili peppers, which are the spicier sister of the Anaheim chili. It's the official state vegetable, and the peppers often act as an essential ingredient in everything from sauces and stews to chili rellenos. Chilies, both red and green, have been a part of New Mexican culture for more than a century, and now officials with the State Department of Agriculture are hoping to share the love. But as KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, doing so has come with a few challenges.
If you're from New Mexico, you know exactly what this sound is. For the uninitiated, this is the sound of green chilies, crackling as they rotate inside a large metal basket that's being heated by a powerful propane-fueled flame. It's harvest season in the Land of Enchantment right now, which means for the next few weeks, industrial-scale roasters like this will be commonplace along street corners and grocery store parking lots across the state.
In red or green, or you can get one of each.
I'm going to do, one of each, please.
Katie Goetz is with the New Mexico Department of Agriculture. She says through a program called Get Your Fix, officials are trying to convince people in other regions of the country why they too should choose the New Mexico chili pepper over a pepper grown somewhere else.
What chili is, first off, point to how we use it in New Mexico, but also talk about how they can incorporate it into some of their local fare.
The goal is to increase demand and brand awareness for the green chili in particular, much like Florida has done for its orange crop. But it's not an easy task. In 2014, New Mexican farmers planted just under 8,000 acres of chilies, which was a 43-year low. Drought has played some role in the decline, but Dino Cervantes, the president of the New Mexico Chili Association, says the real issue is the availability of labor.
We need more product, we can grow more product, but we can't find the people to harvest it.
This labor shortage is an industry-wide issue. Census data show the number of farm workers in New Mexico dropped by about 5% since 2002. And nationwide, the number of hired farm workers shrank from about 3.4 million to just around 1 million over the last century. Cervantes says part of that has to do with the fact that young people aren't seeking jobs in agriculture at the rates they used to, going instead to bigger cities for careers in tourism and entertainment. He adds immigration policies haven't helped either.
Started noticing realizing that we had a problem probably in the late 80s, early 90s, and as the industry has grown more and more and peppers have become more popular. You know, it's become a bigger and bigger issue.
Cervantes says New Mexico is losing market share to other chili-producing countries like Mexico and India. Today, about 80% of chili peppers on store shelves in this country are imported. But Cervantes adds he's still optimistic about the New Mexico chili's future, as new harvesting and destemming machines are beginning to show some promising results. Like the Edgar Moses 1010 one-row chili picker, for example. In a recent test, this harvester made quick work of a row of chili peppers with relatively little damage. In just a few seconds, a pepper makes the trip from the plant to a collection bucket through two spiral tubes.
So I'm very pleased with the way this worked.
Stephanie Walker, a plant scientist at New Mexico State University, explains that while the New Mexico red chili has been mechanically harvested for about a decade, doing so with the green chili has been a bit trickier. Its flesh is more delicate. To avoid the potential for damage, farmers traditionally have had to hand harvest it at a very specific time.
The growers put a lot of money in up front to get to that point where they have a crop ready to be harvested. And if you can't harvest it within that peak window, it's going to quickly turn red and then you're going to quickly lose it.
She says the green chili's vulnerabilities are partly responsible for the loss of acreage. Many farmers have been opting to grow a less labor-intensive crop, like cotton or alfalfa. But Walker explains, with innovations like these, acreage could begin to rebound.
It helps level the playing field with countries that may have very, very large, low-paid labor forces.
And with that more level playing field, the NMDA hopes this New Mexican staple can finally command a larger place on grocery store shelves across the country. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, reporting from Los Lunas, New Mexico.
Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on the show, a conversation that Steve will be having with Cheech Marin about his Chicano art collection. We'll also hear how the Arizona Cardinals have started creating expectations for themselves. Those stories and a whole lot more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Bayan. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. The news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John, the substantial one, Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Good story ideas, all of it. Send it our way, the show at kjzz.org. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, growing Arizona's economy from within by retaining and expanding local companies. Membership information at phoenixchamber.com.